This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. I finished the chapter last week from The View from Lazy Point by Carl Safina. The chapter is called Travels Polar, Bear Witness, Southeast Alaska. He includes two other trips to polar regions in this book, as well as going month by month from the point of view of his home in far eastern Long Island, which is about 110 miles from Manhattan. This book was published in 2011 by Henry Holt and Company. Carl Safina is way up there in my top list of favorite people to read, and I can't get away from him. We're going to travel now, not to Southeast Alaska, but we're going to go to the Atlantic Ocean, to Lazy Point, in the month of September. The migration is really building up, and his descriptions of being there will make you think you are there, the great eastern shore of North America. So this is the September chapter from the wonderful book, The View from Lazy Point, A Natural Year in an Unnatural World. Tempus fugit, wrote Virgil. Time flees. Where has summer gone? Seeing the first group of black scoters bobbing nonchalantly in the south side surf with terns flying overhead is as close as one can get to spanning summer and winter in the same glance. On the beach there is no sign of piping plovers. They're gone, like the summer lovers. I let Kenzie off the leash and she lopes ahead. The early migrants include some of my neighbors whose cottages are mere summertime playhouses. When the calendar strikes 9, they scramble out of them like hermit crabs moving to bigger shells. They're pulling their boats, wrapping them until next summer. I pity them for missing the best weather and the most energized time of the year, all coming up in the next couple of months. Summer has weeks left. But once the calendar displays the word September, you'd think it was Latin for evacuate. Evacuation was on the minds of some as a hurricane was slotted to pass just east of here. Turns out it weakened and veered far out to sea, so we didn't get much weather from it. But for 2 days it lobbed 10-foot swells, which broke into the biggest kind of surf we see, dumping sand and seawater onto neighborhood streets. Most of us who went for a look soon fled. I'd barely gotten a glimpse when I was forced to scramble up a dune to higher ground. One older gentleman, having realized the beach was too hazardous, had turned back up the path to rejoin his family when a piston of surging water knocked him down from behind, immediately snatching his glasses and thus most of his eyesight. His children and grandchildren rushed to his aid, holding him by the arms as the water receded, preventing the wave from getting even more of him. By the next evening, the manic swells were gone and the surf went back to snoring. In the bays and the sound, this has turned out to be a really big year for small fishes. Neighbors who've been here for decades, like the Badkins, say they've never seen so many baby bunkers and big silver sides. Across the near shore surface water, you can see them flipping circles in the rich light of late afternoon, schools so big they look like rain. This summer's fish bonanza has handed the terns an extremely successful breeding season. Many, many young are on the wing. They easily equal their parents in number and in appetite. Over 20,000 adults breed within 10 miles of here, and now they've come to Lazy Point with all their flying children. For the adult terns, this means no more carrying fish all the way to distant nests. But adults are still feeding young birds that must continue developing the skill it takes to seize a tiny fish in a headlong plunge. Having left their breeding islands, terns are massing mightily along our shore. Meanwhile, those fish swarms are beginning to move out into the sound. And each evening this week, the dark schools have been shadowed by extraordinary tern flocks, stretching more or less continuously for several miles between Lazy Point and Cartwright Shoal. They wage intense aerial bombardment at the fluidly moving fish schools. They're stoking up for their next big transition. The ranks of terns born and bred here must now be augmented with migrants moving down from the Maritimes and New England. Through binoculars against the setting sun, the terns look at times like smoke. In recent days, several ospreys have been among them, hovering high, hunting the bigger fish lurking around the small fish swarms. It's an extremely impressive display of life at the apogee of summer. The year's productivity mounded and piled past the angle of repose. It is a world lush with the living, a world that, despite the problems, still has what it takes to really produce. Cormorants continue piling into the harbor daily. They're not going to miss out on fishing like this. Hundreds of the dark, sodden birds, swimming in line formations, continue driving herds of small fishes into panics that frenzy the attending terns. Black terns from Canadian lakes and marshes have joined the common, least, and roseate terns. All these birds and the bluefish and other fishes must rake off an incredible number of small fish daily, taking the profits of summer. Yet legions of the little ones still swim. Again this afternoon, resting terns and their young by the thousands are gathered on various Lazy Point shores and bay bars, chattering, and a sudden silence takeoff of many hundreds of terns prompts the thought, look for a falcon. Sure enough, on comes the falcon, high. The first southbound peregrine of the year, the slow tilt toward autumn marked by this exclamation of life within its own parentheses of wings. The falcon requires birds to make the bird it is, and several paths can lead to making a falcon. Soil into plants, into seeds, into birds, into falcons. Or plants into insects, into birds, into falcon. Or dissolve nutrients into plankton, into fish, into terns, into falcon. The falcon heaps all this energy as a tribute to its own bright burn. It rises higher, higher. Someday this glowing ember called a falcon, this cloud-splitting crossbow, as startling as a pirate flag in a telescope, will be a pile of feathers and maggots in the rain, the way of all flesh. But this isn't that day. Now out of sight, and now a speck in the binoculars, hiding in the heights, it determines its next taxpayer and calculates its trajectory. The falcon merely tilts its head, close parentheses, and the acceleration seems impossible. Fastest living thing. It is not that death comes so fast. It is that between the bookends of nothingness, we have this magnificent glowing life upon whose pages we can write book after book, or which we can leave blank. How many ways shall we make it count? How full or meager? The chosen tern, cool in the face of imminent end, sidesteps like matador before meteor. Falcon misses, tail rudder twitches, and the momentum shoots it skyward. Now bereft of the element of surprise, it flies across the bay, while close above it reel a blizzard of indignant terns. It angles along the marsh and then vanishes toward the ocean. In coming days, these tern flocks will rise high and circle the shores and begin shrinking as though evaporating. They've got the urge for going, and they'll begin to go. This rich glimpse of death-defying life, this is the way it's supposed to be. And most astoundingly, this is the way it is. Terns' lives are shaped by real fish and real falcons. We shape our lives around things that aren't there, haunted by ghosts and demons, busily at work moving pieces of paper and screenfuls of black squiggles from one desk to another, and somehow in the process, we risk all there is. By mid-September, the light has paled. Sunrise comes later, dusk earlier. The dawn bird chorus, so energizing in the spring and early summer, is gone. Only blue jays announce the day, their raucous calls ringing through the cool mornings. No mockingbirds play minstrel to the dead of night. That's not to say the world has fallen silent. Insects fill the air with a deep pile trill that carpets every corner of night, colors the dusk, and tints the morning. It's time for their cadenza. The Virginia creeper's green vines of summer are reddening. The red deer of summer are browning. Beech plums are darkening. Is it a coincidence that the heaviest set of beech plums anyone can recall and the heaviest schools of small fishes both occurred this year? The plums are also truly sweet, sweeter than I've ever tasted. Yesterday afternoon, rain came with clouds so dark I switched on a light in my office at 4 p.m. But overnight, a strong cool wind cleared the air of moisture. Dawn came, bell clear, like an authentic breath of autumn. A cool and steady northwest wind like this lifts the tails of many migrants. Today it has tree swallows moving. They're riding that breeze across the water, coming on, headed south. You don't see them over the wide distances of the bays and the sound, but they're there. You see them materialize as if from the breeze itself, as they get within a few hundred yards of the shore. Their constant trickle adds up to thousands upon thousands. My neighbor, Georgia, works in Manhattan and visits on weekends. She's standing on the beach with me, admiring water and sky. I point out the swallows making landfall overhead. They're crossing the threshold of shore at altitudes of 30 to 50 feet. Just the birds we can actually see are arriving at a rate of maybe 20 per minute. I have no reason to think this isn't happening along miles of our shoreline. Impressed by all the birds coming off the bay, Georgia brings her mother, Lee, out to sea. When the swallows reach our marshes, they'll mass up, feeding heavily on flying insects, then go to the ocean beach and turn right down the coast. Occasionally, I've seen the beaches thronged with rivers of swallows, great snaking pulses of wings, in flocks of tens of thousands, plus continuous volleys of smaller groups, actually taking hours to pass. At this time of year, all the birds' ranks are swollen by the season's many young on their first migration, energetically making their bid for survival. With the odds stacked so heavily against them, I wonder if they feel anything like the appropriate terror. All I see is them giving it all they've got. Robins and jays are also crossing the marshes in visible flocks. Vireos, hummingbirds, tanagers, flycatchers, they're all passing now in the southbound lane. Assorted warblers, American redstarts, northern parulas, magnolia, pine, chestnut-sided, cerulean, black and white, prairie, their spring candy colors gone, slip by mostly unnoticed except by the most avid birders and the always avid hawks. Two dark dove-sized falcons, merlins, zipline the edges of the marsh and the pines. There's much to hunt. I watch a few migrating dragonflies catch mosquitoes with deft precision and almost untrackable speed. The merlins sport after the dragonflies and hairy small birds in quick sprints or high spiraling chases up into the open sky or relentless pursuit over open water. Riding the skies from the Arctic tundra, black-bellied plovers are again with us, some already in winter feather, some still bearing the outlines of their handsome breeding plumage. They still have a long way to go. Also from up north, those cosmopolitan travelers, the ruddy turnstones, who've met and greeted me from the high Arctic to the tropics, from Europe to Alaska to the Caribbean, continue filtering through. Along the same shores where the birds' spring passage coincided with the sparse emerald shoots of new marsh plants, blooming sea lavender and seaside goldenrod, now lace the luxuriant end-of-summer marshes with color and scent. By the third week of September, the tern numbers have deflated from tens of thousands to a couple hundred. Some are gone, some have moved just a few miles to the point where the autumn scene is building as schools of anchovies are beginning to mass, and their predators are taking up their annual position for the autumn gauntlet known as the Blitz. Between the North and South Forks, which form the tail of Long Island's vaguely fishy shape, the Peconic River enters salt water at a place called Riverhead. There's a public aquarium there, and I've received an invitation from a couple of their fish keepers to join them on an expedition to catch tropical reef fish for their coral reef and warm water exhibits. But the location isn't the Caribbean or the Coral Triangle of the Western Pacific. I will board no aircraft. No palm trees will wave welcome. The collecting grounds are just a few miles from here in the same bay system where I've often encountered a decidedly temperate contingent of sea robins, flounder, and squid. That's what I mean about the magic in the fluidity of water. You can stare at the same bay all summer, but under the surface, worlds change. The winds of summer push warm surface water up the coast. Eddies break off the Gulf Stream and come whirling over the shelf and occasionally hit the beaches and inlets with startlingly blue, clear water. In that water ride the eggs and larvae of reef fishes from 1,000 miles south. Thus do juveniles of tropical fishes of many kinds come to us in streaming tongues of warm water to live bathed in the solar-heated shallows of our late summer bays. But they're not equipped to migrate south. Having made a wrong turn or been caught in currents bound too far north, the tropicals, here by accident, are stranded. And soon, when the breath of autumn swings northerly and the frost is on the pumpkins, they'll have nothing to do but chill out and die. So rather than mount expensive expeditions to warm places to take fishes that could survive to adulthood and reproduce within their normal range, the aquarium guys and some of their colleagues from other aquariums in the Northeast, inland as far as Wisconsin, and even from the South, now come here to grant doomed juveniles a long life in comfortable captivity. It's probably the only win-win in fishing. I'm going to stop there. I can't wait to read you the next part of this chapter and go on to talking more about reef fishes in Palau. I'm just learning about Palau. What an incredible story that is. I wanted to mention that we have peregrine falcons. Thanks to falconers breeding them in captivity after they disappeared from the wild in eastern North America, we have them wild again, nesting on cliffs on the Mississippi River. They are incredible to see. His description is so good in this chapter, what it's like to watch a falcon hunting. This glowing ember called a falcon, this cloud-splitting crossbow, as startling as a pirate flag in a telescope. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you so much for listening.